The Palestinian envoy to the United Nations has called for immediate and genuine measures to end the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The United Nations says Israel prevents the delivery of aid to people in the devastated Gaza Strip as the death toll from the bombings rise past 23,700. And Iran's foreign minister has hailed the Yemeni army's actions against Israeli interests in the Red Sea, slamming the US and the UK for launching attacks on Yemen. Thank you for joining us. The Palestinian ambassador to the UN has called on the international body to take immediate measures to end the Israeli genocide in Gaza.
If you want to prevent the forced displacement, if you want an army of humanitarian officers from the United Nations to be able to deliver humanitarian assistance to every corner in the Gaza Strip, you cannot do it without a ceasefire. The SG is correct, Mr. Griffith is correct, and all those who believe in that are correct. And we thank you for the unanimous decision or position of rejecting forced displacement. We acknowledge that. We appreciate that. And we thank you also for the unanimous position of asking for humanitarian aid to be up to scale as the SG requested. And we thank you for that. What you are not unanimously agreeing to is the requirement to do it, the guarantee to do it, which is calling for a ceasefire and for a ceasefire now. And we hope that soon that you will become unanimous in that decision to call for a ceasefire.
Mansour made the remarks during a meeting of the UN Security Council on the situation in Gaza. In the meeting, the Chinese delegation called for an immediate ceasefire as well as measures to alleviate the humanitarian disaster in the coastal territory. Russia also echoed the call for a truce and raised concern over a spillover of the conflict to the region. Meanwhile, several top UN officials have expressed concern about the possible forced transfer or deportation of Palestinian population from the Gaza Strip. They say any such move will be in violation of international law. The United Nations Humanitarian Office says Israel systematically denies delivering aid to northern Gaza.
The operations in the north have become increasingly more complicated. We had systematic refusal from the Israeli side of our effort to get there, to access the north. But in particular, they have been very systematic to not allowing us to support hospitals, which is something that is reaching a point of a level of inhumanity that for me is beyond comprehension.
De Domenico said on Friday that the OCHA had not been authorized to return to Jabalia. He added that Israel did not allow the UN office to bring sufficient fuel to Al-Shifa Hospital. In separate comments, the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said Israel has failed to uphold the fundamental principles of international humanitarian law, warning of other crimes in the besieged territory. Aid deliveries to northern Gaza have been limited since the start of Israel's genocidal war. The majority of Gaza's 2.3 million population have been displaced, suffering acute shortages of food, water, and medicine. The number of Palestinians killed in nearly 100 days of Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip has risen past 23,700. The health ministry in Gaza says more than 60,000 others have also been injured. That's why thousands more are still missing and presumed dead under the rubble of their destroyed homes. Israel has launched fresh attacks on residential buildings in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. The Israeli regime also conducted heavy artillery strikes against the Al-Burej and Al-Maghazi refugee camps. The city of Khan Yunis in the south also came under attack. The government media office in Gaza says the Israeli regime is using starvation as a weapon to force Palestinians out of the besieged territory. Tehran has hailed Yemen's actions against Israeli interests in the Red Sea as the US and its allies launch attacks on Yemen. Iran's foreign minister slammed the Thursday strikes, which Washington claimed were aimed at ensuring freedom of navigation in the Red Sea. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Yemen is fully committed to maritime and shipping security, but took action in solidarity with Gazans. The foreign minister also said the White House needs to stop its military support for Tel Aviv in order for security to return to the entire region. Yemen's military has been targeting Israeli-linked vessels to block their passage through the Red Sea in defiance of US warnings to end such attacks. Both Tehran and Sana'a have also repeatedly warned the US against any provocative action that endangers the peace and security of the region. The head of the Supreme Political Council of Yemen has warned the US and the UK against any aggression on his country. Mahdi al-Mashat said the US must note that Yemen is the graveyard of invaders. The top official said the US and the UK are responsible for the militarization of the Red Sea, not Yemen. He added that ending Israeli onslaught on Gaza is the only solution for the current problems, not invading the Yemeni territory. Al-Mashat said Sana'a will not stop supporting Palestine despite the American aggression. Meanwhile, the spokesman for Yemen's armed forces has vowed revenge after the US and the UK carried out airstrikes on the country.
The American and British enemy bears full responsibility for its criminal aggression against our Yemeni people, and it will not go unanswered and unpunished.
The spokesman said the US and British militaries carried out 73 strikes targeting the capital Sana'a and four other Yemeni cities. Sari said the offensive killed five Yemeni armed forces and injured six others. The strikes on Yemen were launched from air and sea late on Thursday. They were conducted at the US president's direction and with the support of Australia, Canada, the Netherlands and Bahrain. Joe Biden said the strikes were a direct response to what he called unprecedented Yemeni attacks against international maritime vessels in the Red Sea. Yemen says its operations pose no threat to international shipping as the attacks are only aimed at Israeli-linked vessels. Yemen has promised to continue its attacks until the Gaza genocide ends.
Yemenis from all walks of life took to the streets of the capital Sana'a to decry the US-Britain strikes that targeted several cities across Yemen early Friday in support of Israel. They also denounced the US-drafted resolution on the Red Sea that was adopted by the United Nations Security Council shortly before the strikes. The protesters also reaffirmed their support for their country's pro-Palestine operations despite the Western aggression.
The strikes launched by America and Britain were aimed at discouraging the Yemenis from carrying out military operations in the Red Sea. But Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi was clear in his speech that no one would be able to stop the Yemenis from supporting their Palestinian brothers. We in the Popular Front on Palestine appreciate what our Yemeni brothers are doing. And in 75 years, we have not found anyone who stood with us like the Yemeni people, despite the American-British threat.
The protesters chanted slogans in support of the Yemeni armed forces' operations against Israeli-linked ships in the Red Sea. They stressed that despite the Western aggression against their country, they will not back down from their position in supporting the Palestinian people, whatever the cost.
The Yemeni armed forces were anticipating these strikes, and our position is clear and will not change, that we will continue to prevent Israeli-linked ships from reaching the occupied ports until medicine and food are allowed to enter Gaza, and the genocide committed by Israel is stopped. The American-British strikes violated Yemen's sovereignty, but did not affect the capabilities of the Yemeni army.
The strikes followed the UN Security Council's adoption of a draft resolution submitted by Washington and Japan that demanded an immediate end to attacks by Yemeni forces on Israeli-owned or Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea. Yemeni officials have strongly condemned the strikes and vowed a painful response to them.
The crowd here is sending a strong message to the US and the UK. The demonstrators vow that the aggression against their country will not go unpunished. They also say operations against Israeli-linked vessels in the Red Sea will end if Israel puts an end to its genocidal war on Gaza. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
Iranians have held new rallies across the country in support of the Palestinians in Gaza. The protesters took to the streets in different Iranian cities after the Friday prayers. They chanted slogans against Israel and its main supporter, the US, over the genocide against Palestinians. Since the Gaza war began, the Iranian people have held rallies on what they call Fridays of anger over the atrocities in the Palestinian territory. Anger mainly boils on the US over its support for Israel through sending military aid and vetoing anti-Israel resolutions at the UN Security Council.
We Iranians surely stand with our brothers in Yemen, and we strongly condemn invasion of United States and US-led forces on Yemeni bases. And we believe that the Yemeni people do the right things, and they must stop any ship, any vessel going to Israel, and they must withstand, and we are with them surely.
We condemn the U.S. and support the people of Yemen. We will continue saying this to America, Israel, and U.K. until the day of resurrection.
We, all the Muslim nations, must unite against Israel, and we should try to destroy Israel and stop its atrocities.
The more the U.S. supports Israel, the more it harms itself and its allies. As long as America continues its misdeeds, we, the Muslim nations, will support the axis of resistance, and we are steadfast in supporting our revolution until the last drop of our blood. We will not leave the Palestinians alone, and we support Yemen.
Jordanians have once again taken the streets of Amman in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza amid brutal Israeli strikes. But this time the protests saw them also affirming support for Yemen, which has been hit by Israel's allies. Falling rain did not prevent the Jordanians from voicing their support for Gazans who are subjected to the US-backed Israeli genocide. They also expressed their support for the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, denouncing Israeli plans to forcibly displace Gazans. The demonstrators also condemned the strikes by the US and Britain. Bahrain also saw similar protests, with participants condemning the strikes on Gaza and Yemen. The Bahraini protesters slammed the Al Khalifa regime for backing the strikes on Yemen. They also called for the closure of the US bases on their land, as well as the Israeli embassy, condemning the normalization of ties with Tel Aviv. Bahrain's main opposition group, Al-Wafaq, also denounced the attack on Yemen as a war crime, warning that it was aimed at destabilizing the region to serve the interests of Israel. Al-Wafaq also slammed the Manama regime over its participation in the US-led coalition in the Red Sea. Bahrain is the only Arab nation to join it. Despite the creation of the coalition, Yemen says its retaliatory operations against Israeli-linked ships will continue until the regime's genocidal war on Gaza ends and the siege on the territory is lifted. The International Court of Justice at The Hague has heard submissions from lawyers representing South Africa who have accused the Israeli regime of committing genocide in Gaza. The justices are now considering the merits of the case, which has been vehemently opposed by the regime in Tel Aviv, who have blamed the resistance for their actions. Latifa Abu Chakra was at the ICJ at The Hague and filed us this report.
Israel
It has been a historic 2 days at the International Court of Justice, where the former apartheid state of South Africa instituted proceedings against the Israeli occupation for their genocide against the Palestinian people. South Africa made a compelling case, evidencing clearly that the Genocide Convention has been violated under several categories.
What South Africa has done is point very specifically to the violations of the Genocide Convention, Articles 2A, 2B, 2C and 2D, across all levers of depriving the Palestinians of food, of water, of displacement and of killing of civilians.
In addition to the large pro-Palestinian crowds gathered outside of The Hague, demonstrating their support for a ceasefire, of which included prominent political figures from Ireland, Barcelona, Belgium and the UK, 900 popular movements, unions, political parties, faith-based and secular organizations have signed an open letter backing South Africa's case. Representatives of the occupation regime sought to distance and called the picture painted in court distorted and a manipulative description of reality. In ignoring the context of the 75-year occupation, their defense has been labeled as illogical and a desperate attempt to score points. What is also on trial here is the United Nations' ability to deliver on its own promises.
This is one of the biggest tests in modern times for the West, for democracy, and for international institutions such as this. And I'm hoping that they can rise to the challenge.
The repetition of the propaganda they've peddled these past 3 months will not work this time. We have seen the mask fall. And the Western world, which has long portrayed itself as the bastion of democracy, now has to prove that it can extend those same rights to the Global South. Latifa Abu Chakra, the International Court of Justice, The Hague.
And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Take care for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Recently, Iran and Russia announced to have finalized an agreement to trade in their local currencies instead of the US dollar. The agreement, signed during a meeting between the governors of the two countries' central banks in Russia, enables banks and economic actors to use infrastructures, including non-SWIFT interbank systems, to deal in local currencies. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, both Iran and Russia are subject to U.S. sanctions, which have motivated the emerging allies to craft their own path in the global economy and break away from traditional monetary systems, adding momentum to a new trend among world countries to shift away from the greenback. In recent years, Iran and Russia have stepped up oil sales in alternative currencies and found buyers in China, India, and elsewhere that are happy to buy these exports, often at lower prices, because paying in a domestic currency rather than dollars lowers transaction costs. Last October, Royal Bank of Canada reported that 25% of Russia's trade with countries other than China was settled with the Chinese yuan. The US dollar's dominant role in the international monetary system has enabled the country to act as the world's watchdog and use threats of exclusion from the dollar-based financial system as a political leverage against the nations which it does not see eye to eye. Seeing a risk that Washington could act similarly against them in the future, other governments have also moved to reduce their dependence on dollar payments. Brazil, the UAE and Saudi Arabia have also recently taken steps laying the groundwork for trade that sidesteps the dollar. Oil is at the center of the shift. A JP Morgan report in September confirmed that more and more of the oil trade is taking place with currencies other than the dollar. Russia has been selling in Chinese yuan, Russian rubles, Emirati dirhams and Indian rupees, according to the Institute of International Finance. Iran, which mostly sells oil to China in yuan, also has stepped up exports. Last year, Pakistan began paying for Russian oil shipments in the Chinese currency amid a dollar shortage in the South Asian country. An Indian refiner took in a shipment of Emirati oil and paid for in Indian rupees after the government signed a deal in the summer to trade in their own currencies. Brazil and China completed their first local currency commodity transaction in the fall, involving a shipment of Brazilian pulp. And in November, China and Saudi Arabia reached a currency swap agreement worth around $7 billion, marking another step in the de-dollarization trend. However, the most serious challenge to the dollar's dominance is coming from BRICS countries, thanks to the bloc's growing size and influence over global trade. The group of emerging countries was formed in 2006 by Brazil, Russia, India, and China, with South Africa joining in 2010. BRICS rang in 2024 by inducting five new countries, including Iran, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, and Ethiopia. But more countries have submitted applications to join it and its de-dollarization mission, including as many as 16 new nations, which may join BRICS in 2024. Egypt, Ethiopia, and Saudi Arabia surround the Suez Canal, a key passage for goods to flow into international markets that gives BRICS influence over 12% of all global trade. The group has now a combined population of about 3.5 billion people, with a combined economy worth over $28.5 trillion, or about 28% of the global economy. In August last year, Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, called for the BRICS nations to create a common currency for trade and investment between each other. BRICS is also looking to create its own internet services and not depend on American technology for news and social media. Much to the U.S. dismay, it is not the only group seeking to shed the dollar's dominance. Last summer, 10 Asian countries agreed to stop trading in the U.S. dollar and use native currencies for cross-border settlements. The bloc comprises Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam, which are likely on the list of applicants to join BRICS. In a recent op-ed for the Foreign Policy magazine, former White House economist Joe Sullivan warned that a BRICS currency could topple the dollar and put it in a similar position as the British pound, which has slipped from international dominance in 1800s. Sullivan touched on major sway of the bloc in commodities markets, where Saudi Arabia, Iran, and the UAE are among the world's top exporters of fossil fuels, while Brazil, China, and Russia are major exporters of precious metals. Saudi Arabia, Sullivan said, owns over $100 billion in U.S. bonds, which has helped bring BRICS total holdings in U.S. Treasury over $1 trillion. If countries ditch the dollar, the currency will circulate back to the U.S. and lead to inflation, where the prices of housing, rent, and basic daily necessities will skyrocket and become unaffordable. The remaining countries which have not removed the dollar from their economic cycle would have to share the burden with the United States. De-dollarization would also neutralize U.S. sanctions against countries such as Iran and Russia and ease up commercial exchanges among them. Moreover, it would lead to economic pressure on Western countries promoting Europe to carry out trade in euro and any currencies other than the dollar, sending the greenback further into a tailspin.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and since we're on the threshold of the blessed month of Rajab, on the first day of which happens to be the blessed birthday anniversary of Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace be upon him, the fifth infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, we now present you a beautiful saying from him. You are the son of 3 days, your birthday, the day on which you will be taken to your grave, and the day on which you will be resurrected to meet your Lord. That will be surely a horrible day, depending on one's deeds.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the detriments of using abusive and inappropriate language. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
fair speech is a sign of a believer and a Muslim. A Muslim doesn't use foul language. A Muslim does not use curse words in his speech. But someone doesn't like that, you know, when mu'mineen and the believers and the Muslims, they do not use these foul words. There is someone who doesn't like that. And you may be thinking, who is that someone? Well, let's ask the Quran. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Holy Quran, "And say to my servants that they speak that which is best. Surely Satan sows dissension among them. Surely Satan is an enemy to man." It is out of the enmity of Satan that he misguides human beings to use foul language. Unfortunately, the Western culture, especially the music industry, you know, that we see today, it has normalized the use of improper language for many youth. They should pay special attention to the importance of not using curse words in their speech. The Prophet of Allah, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, says in this regard, "Surely of the most wicked people are those who others hate because of their abuse." You may think that using inappropriate language is cool, especially if you're a youth. You know, this is something that goes around and is seen throughout the world, that if you are in your youthhood, you know, you may end up thinking that, oh, it is something cool to use inappropriate words in your speech. But remember, others hate when you do that. When you use those abusive language, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not happy with your speech. Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam are not happy with that speech. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the detriments of using abusive and inappropriate language. So, you know, what are some of the downsides and detriments of using abusive and inappropriate language? The Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, said, "Surely Allah abhors those who are impudent and abusive." He also said, "He whose tongue people hate will go to hell." Prophet added, "The most wicked is he whom people respect for fear of his ill treatment and to remain safe from the harm of his abuse." He also said, "The worst of people with Allah on the Day of Judgment are those whom people honor for fear of their wickedness." These sayings should not, you know, just be listened to and you know, kind of ignored. These should be an eye-opener for those who are not sensitive towards this issue. A devout Shia would not be a source of shame for Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam said, "Tell people the best of what you expect them to tell you." Imam Sadiq alayhi salam similarly says, "My followers, be an ornament for us and do not be a shame for us. Tell people good words, guard your tongues, and keep them back from the idle talk and evil words." He also said, "Fear Allah and keep your tongues, except from fair speech. Surely impudence, abuse, and shrewdness are of the signs of hypocrisy. And surely the most hated man with Allah is he whose tongue people fear." This was the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Iranian missiles range reach Tel Aviv.
Part 1.
From 3,500 years before the birth of Jesus Christ until the late 20th century, about 14,500 wars have broken out and over 3 billion people have lost their lives due to wars. Only 300 years of history of mankind have actually passed in peace. This is what Conway Henderson says in his book. Ever since its emergence, the U.S. government has been a pioneer of wars all over the world by directly or indirectly waging wars in 37 countries. The current figures on the U.S. military conflicts after World War II show that Washington's so-called plans to expand liberty have sent 20 to 30 million people to their graves. This is why military experts believe that for every one person that's killed in any war, there are 10 more people injured. This means the U.S. has so far caused incidents similar to the 9/11 attacks 10,000 times in different parts of the world. By looking into the U.S. background since its emergence, we don't see anything other than a bleak and bloody history of aggression, except for a few years. The fact of the matter is that West Asia was a focal point for the U.S. because of its strategic importance and the political geography and energy resources needed in the world. The U.S. military bases in the southern Persian Gulf littoral states, Turkey, Iraq, and Afghanistan, are proof. But there's only one reason for the U.S. presence in the region and its special attention to it, and that is Iran. In 1979, Iran shattered the political equations of the White House with its Islamic Revolution. Iran's progress during the 8-year war with Iraq, especially in its missiles industry, was beyond imagination, and it left the U.S. bewildered and, of course, worried more than any other country. Soon, Iranian missiles range reached the U.S. beating heart in the region, namely Tel Aviv. So, the alarm had now sounded for the Yankees to do something.
Iran aggressively pursues these weapons and exports terror. States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
On September 11, 2001, the Twin Towers in New York collapsed after a fabricated scenario, and it paved the path for the U.S. to officially launch the military deployment to West Asia. So, the U.S. Army invaded Afghanistan on Sunday, October 7, 2001, with its full military force. Two years later, on March 30, 2003, the U.S. waged a new war in the region with its military aggression against Iraq under the pretext of another unfounded claim that Saddam Hussein's regime was making weapons of mass destruction. Yet, despite all of this, the question is, why would the U.S. send its military forces thousands of miles away from home? That's why, after 2002, the Pentagon allocated a huge budget for construction, equipping, and expansion of ground, naval, and air bases in the Persian Gulf and adjacent regions. The U.S. has 21 bases in six Persian Gulf Arab states that are currently the largest bases to provide the U.S. troops in the region with facilities and equipment. Among the six Persian Gulf nations, Kuwait hosts six U.S. bases. Although it is a small base, it gives the U.S. the largest access for facilities in the region. After Kuwait, Qatar hosts the highest number of bases for the terrorist U.S. Army. Oman and the United Arab Emirates didn't want to be left behind, so they also handed over swaths of their land to the Yankees. The U.S. adventurism in the region shows that with hundreds of intelligence units on the ground and thousands of hours of drone flights, they are supposed to control the region in a way that they do not miss any event in the region. These are only a few examples of the reasons behind U.S. military presence with its full force in the region to counter Iran. Concurrent with the military campaign, they piled pressure on Iran through diplomatic means and imposed missile and nuclear activities related sanctions to tighten the noose around the country. Iran's missile power would stop the U.S. from causing insecurity despite its muscle flexing in the region.
Every time I think about those kids.
That caused fury for the officials at the White House more than anything else. So they opted for the next option on the table. During all those years they were in Iraq, they churned out a new generation of murderers in the format of the Daesh terrorist group in their prisons, especially in Camp Buka, and triggered widespread bloodbaths and destruction in a large part of the region.
I call President Obama and Hillary Clinton the founders of ISIS. They're the founders. You get the MVP award. ISIS will hand her the most valuable player award. Her only competition is Barack Obama, between the two.
Muslims in the region, who were supposed to unite hands for the liberation of Palestine, were now at each other's throats after the accurately calculated scheme. So the occupied territories became a safer place for the Zionists. Costly arrangements in Iraq and Syria were made for the big cause, namely occupation of Iran. But they had overlooked this part of the plan. reinforcing and reorganizing the formidable wall of the axis of resistance through the Islamic Republic of Iran's support. Anyways, the White House officials couldn't easily overcome the challenge, and the U.S. did not achieve a remarkable victory through this tactic either. Bearing the failures and Iran's invincibility had become harder for them. They decided to use Attack Fury and MKO terrorist agents inside of Iran. Like their attacks on Iran's parliament, Imam Khomeini's shrine, and the army parade in Ahvaz. But it seems they had forgotten again that the fireworks would incur a huge wrath. The IRGC forces know full well what makes arrogant powers more enraged, so that's what they do against the enemies, so they'll taste the defeat more bitterly. Iran once again flaunted its missile power to the world, so they won't get any ideas about doing anything stupid. Now, in response to any aggression, Iran will level their bases to the ground with its ballistic missiles with pinpoint accuracy. After 8 years of destruction and cold-blooded carnage of civilians, Daesh had no achievement for the U.S. after the huge costs. And it meant a new hard defeat for the U.S. in its adventurism in West Asia.
$7 trillion, not billion, not million. $7 trillion with a T. Nobody ever heard of the word trillion until 10 years ago. We spent $7 trillion in the Middle East.
The special images taken by IRGC Aerospace Forces experts from U.S. spy drones show the United States' all-out support for the terrorists in the region. The U.S. could not stand to see Iran's achievements against its terrorist groups. This time around, it bit off more than it could chew. Donald Trump's advisors had decided to revive the more abundant maximum pressure campaign with a military shock. The best shock would be to eliminate one of the most important factors of the failure of U.S. policies in West Asia.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At 1:20 a.m., Friday, January 3, 2020, something happened that shouldn't have.
In defense of our nation and its citizens, last night at my direction, the United States military successfully executed a flawless precision strike that killed the number one terrorist anywhere in the world, Qasem Soleimani.
Trump, who was filled with fear, claimed responsibility for the attack. Yet, despite all of this, the gambler president threatened that in case Iran responded, 52 targets in Iran will be hit. The blatant rudeness had to be responded to quickly. Early morning on Wednesday, January 8th, 2020, at 1:20 a.m., 13 Qiyam and Fateh 313 ballistic missiles were fired from Kermanshah and destroyed a part of U.S. Ain al-Assad base located in the western Al-Anbar province in Iraq.
Thank you.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's multi-billion dollar heavy equipment has been rendered useless. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, "The Zionist regime's military's dismal performance in Gaza and on the Lebanese border has exposed its inadequacies. Once the current regional war goes from low to high intensity, the Zionist regime will experience far greater difficulties than its intelligence analysts foresee." Prior to reviewing the Zionist regime's dire military situation, an important fact must be borne in mind. Currently, the Zionist regime's primary military adversary is the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. The resistance emerged and advanced its capabilities under years of severe siege and incessant military, intelligence, economic, and political attacks. Yet, despite massive external backing, there is growing consensus even among pro-Israeli circles that the Zionist military's performance is far below what was hitherto projected. The bulk of Israel's military hardware comes from the United States. Without the unconditional backing of Washington, any regional army would be able to chew the Zionist army. Amateurs talk tactics, while professionals look at logistics. So let us begin with basic logistical realities. The U.S. is very far from Palestine. It is much further than it is from Ukraine. In the proxy war in Ukraine against Russia, despite the industrial, military, and political backing of numerous EU regimes, the United States is still struggling to adequately supply Ukraine, not just in financial terms, but also in logistical terms. How will the U.S. provide multifaceted logistical backing to the Zionist regime in a geopolitically more hostile environment than the one in Europe? This will be quite problematic. Those in doubt, just think about how a country like Yemen, with determination and geopolitical strategy, has managed to turn the logistics of the global trade upside down. Sana'a is doing this with minimal effort and no direct Iranian participation. Once the regional dimension of the current war in Palestine goes into the higher gear, Iran's role will increase, so will Yemen's. Put two and two together and it becomes quite clear what grand problems await the fabricated regime of Israel from a logistic and geopolitical angle. Let us now return to the micro military matters unfolding in Palestine. Numerous videos emerging from Gaza show the Palestinian resistance is targeting the heavily armed invading Zionist military at very close range. The Zionist regime's multi-billion dollar heavy equipment has been rendered useless. In urban environment, the fight is between two infantries. This is where training along with motivation compensate for lack of sophisticated equipment. At the infantry level, the only clear advantage the Zionist militants have over the Palestinian resistance is probably their access to night vision equipment. In all other aspects, the field is quite leveled. While these may appear as tactical matters, viewed within the broader regional context, they assume much greater significance. It must be remembered that the Palestinian theater of operations against Zionism is one of multiple theaters. When the tactical difficulties the Zionist regime faces in Gaza are combined with the confrontational methodology it faces from Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Iran, each contributing in their own calculated manner, Tel Aviv's prospects look quite grim. If one looks at each of these countries listed within the context of the resistance axis, it becomes clear that the geopolitical leverage combined with logistical and intelligence aspects greatly overstretch Zionist forces. Missiles raining down on Israel from Yemen, Syria, and Lebanon will overwhelm its air defenses. Protracted ground resistance in Palestine, Gaza, and the West Bank is exhausting its infantry and intelligence capabilities. All these factors drain the Zionist regime's economy, and this creates a deadly cocktail for the Zionists when viewed through the time lens. The fabricated regime of Israel has never fought a prolonged war against regionally allied forces that also enjoy state backing. It should also be remembered that the only time the Zionist regime's genocidal military formations fought a conventional style war in recent decades was against Hezbollah in 2006. Experienced regional analysts have concluded that Israel was soundly defeated in 2006. Even in the current conflict, as reported by the Washington Post on January 7th, Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, found that it will be difficult for Israel forces to succeed because its military assets and resources would be spread too thin. Prior to 2006, and even after, the Zionist regime's army was engaged more in police-like activities against poorly equipped and poorly organized civilian-driven resistance groups. This is no longer the case. Today, the Zionist regime is facing much better organized and significantly better equipped and experienced forces, and not just in Palestine. In historical terms, the Israeli regime army can best be described as Soviet-style NKVD units, responsible for terrorizing a society rather than a formidable military force. As the fabricated regime of Israel does not control the regional escalation ladder, the next conventional regional war will be fought on terms and conditions not determined and framed by Tel Aviv or its Western backers. Add the global geopolitical dimension to evolving local factors. Russia's strategic interest is to bog down NATO regimes and their allies in a protracted conflict. NATO regimes are doing the same to Russia in Ukraine. Soon, the Zionist occupiers will get a rude awakening about what the new multipolar world order really is all about.